The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Emily Day, and this is an episode from the Lawfare Archives for November 7th, 2021. The United Nations Climate Change Conference, or the COP26 Summit, has dominated media coverage this week. The goal of these negotiations was to get an agreement to curb carbon emissions fast enough to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. President Biden's major goal was to reassert America's ability to lead the world on climate change. So, for this week, I chose an episode from June 7th, 2012, in which Ken Anderson discusses his book, Living with the UN, American Responsibilities and International Order, and gives insights about the U.S.-UN relationship, the UN as an institution, and international governance more broadly.
Hello. And welcome to the Lawfare Podcast, the special book review editor discusses his own book edition. I'm Benjamin Wittes, and I'm here today in beautiful Palo Alto with Lawfare's own Ken Anderson, who is out here at the Hoover Institution with me. We're taking a break from a meeting of the Hoover Institution Task Force on National Security and Law to discuss Ken's new book, Living with the UN, American Responsibilities and International Order. Ken certainly requires no introduction to the Lawfare readership, so I will offer none. The book, published by the Hoover Press, is an incisive look at the relationship between the United States and the United Nations, at when and how the United States should engage with the UN, and indeed, a look at the UN itself. As Ken writes, why is there still a United Nations at all? How has it managed to survive over time, from 1945 down to the present, given its long record of underperformance, frequent outright failure, and even more frequent irrelevance? Why has not the ruthless evolutionary logic of history pruned it as a failed institutional sapling in a relentlessly competitive forest, as the League of Nations was pruned? So, Ken, what's the book about?
Well, Living with the UN is an attempt to find a way that the United States can live with the UN over the long term. And that means two things. It means understanding that the UN is here and it's here to stay and it's not going anywhere. But it's also an understanding that the UN is not going anywhere, both in the sense that it's a permanent institution and a permanent feature of the landscape, but it's also all grown up and it is what it is, and what it is not particularly pretty.
Does that mean it's not reformable?
It's reformable, I would say, only around the edges, and reform can only really be tactical, contingent, as John Bolton once said, it's ever a task in front of us. It's something which has to be seen as a constant task one day at a time, because it's not really permanently reformable.
Now, there's you invoke Bolton here, but there is a
rejection, I think, implicit in your thesis of a core aspect of sort of what you might call Boltonism, which is the idea that the UN can be remade or that we can sort of reject the UN and that we can, you know, pretend it sort of doesn't exist or else kind of remake it in our image. You're much more fatalist than that.
Yeah, I would say that there's two phases to John Bolton. There is John Bolton, really before he became UN ambassador or acting ambassador, in which his view was exactly, if you remove the top 10 floors off the UN building,
No one would notice.
And also that the U.S. could effectively marginalize the institution and march away from it as a whole. That was not actually what he did when he was ambassador, and I think that it partly represented his understanding in the position that, of course, he had to deal with the institution as it was. I also think it was partly Condoleezza Rice, Secretary Rice, at the time telling him that he was to take the institution seriously. He did, but I think he did so in a way that was, if anything, even more infuriating to people around the UN than his sort of cavalier disregard of it or sort of dismissal of it before. Because what he did was insist on acting like a lawyer, and in negotiations around fundamental UN reform in 2005, he decided to be the Sullivan and Cromwell lawyer for the United States who was going to negotiate every single aspect of UN reform and U.S. relations to it as though it all mattered in court somewhere in a contract. That really, really annoyed people.
And as you describe in the book, was sort of profoundly at odds with the culture of actual UN resolutions, UN negotiations, which you describe as sort of based on an idea that you negotiate nothing with the idea that you can then disregard the outcome.
Yeah, I think the suggestion for the United States from its friends and not so friends was, well, you just have to be a player in order to have any impact on the outcome of all of this. And whether it's the 2005 UN reform process that was a quite formalized process or any of the other things that take place around these processes of consensus. What the U.S. constantly gets told in this is to be a player, you got to be at the table. To have an impact on all of this, you got to be at the table. But don't worry about it because this is a consensus process, and if you don't like it, you can just put it in brackets and that will be the end of it. So the theory is that nobody gets stuck with anything they're truly unhappy with. Unfortunately, that doesn't really work out with regards to the United States. And the reason it doesn't is because the overwhelmingly powerful player in that kind of a system who says no isn't just like any other player who says no. It's a player whose refusal to go along with the consensus process inevitably raises questions about the entire enterprise. And so the costs to that player in saying no are much more than they are to just sort of ordinary run-of-the-mill countries.
So the Bush administration comes in with a view that it can marginalize the UN and ends up being a reluctant multilateral player, somewhat despite itself. The Obama administration comes in with a very different understanding. And also, in your account, falls back.
Yes. And it's important to understand also that it's very, very hard to look back to the very beginning pre-9/11 stance of the initial Bush administration. It wanted to go to the Durban big conference on racism. This was Durban 1. And people said to it, this will end in tears. This you don't seem to understand what you're getting involved in here. And there we were, some number of weeks into it, and Secretary of State Powell had to stage a sort of big walkout because it was just a bust around anti-Semitism and all the usual stuff. Some number of years later, in the opening rounds of the Obama administration, there's Durban 2. And the Obama administration, with equal enthusiasm, says, we're really going to be able to, you know, get involved in this process, and we understand the risks involved, and we understand what happened the last time, but, you know, we're going. And once again, they had to back out. It was in considerable embarrassment. And I think the lesson that arises out of those things is that there are real issues that can't be elided by force of personality or by expressions of goodwill. And the instinct to try and satisfy those things does wind up ending in tears, and they would have been better just avoiding all of those things.
Now, what are those real... Why are there intractable issues that cannot be elided by things that we usually think of as affecting political institutions, like leadership, personalities? I mean, why should we be so fatalistic about the UN? It's here to stay. It's unreformable. We're stuck with it. And why so bleak?
I guess I'd say bleak because the UN is as not just an institution, but a whole set of institutions, a whole set of organs, a whole set of different things, all sort of agglomerated under the UN label, and they're kind of frozen in stasis. They are trapped in what I describe in the book as being antinomies. So on the one hand, this is a collection of member states in which there is the humble secretary general who is the minister responding to those states. On the other hand, it's seen as this kind of forward-looking supranational institution of global governance someday. And those two are not really reconcilable unless one sees a sort of gradual evolution from one to the other. The institution is supposed to be a universal institution open to all states, and yet it's also supposed to be an institution committed to certain kinds of substantive values. Well, not everybody is committed to those values, and so again, another kind of contradiction that locks the institution in place. It's committed to the sovereign equality of states. Everybody, you know, kind of in there is big states, small states, powerful states, not powerful states. It also has a Security Council with the P5 that have got vetoes that nobody else has got. All of these things wind up creating a set of contradictions that freeze the UN around a certain set of positions. The most important of which I suggest in the book is that we're trapped between the UN of today and forever excusing the way the UN fails on so many metrics or just does very, very badly. We wind up excusing all of that on the basis of this institution that it's supposed to be tomorrow. So we look to sort of the glorious future of the UN and then turn out to be really surprised when it causes us to have to excuse anything that goes wrong today on the basis of this thing that it's supposed to become tomorrow. Very damaging, I think, to the institution.
And so why is the young John Bolton wrong? Why isn't the answer to that problem just walk away, do your foreign policy, and forget about this thing that's never going to develop into what the sort of millennial vision had? Okay, you know, after World War II, we had a lot of dreams. We don't have them anymore. Just walk away from it.
I think it's because the UN does actually serve a number of U.S. interests and ideals in ways that the U.S. would find it either extremely costly or just flat out impossible to wind up doing otherwise. So now let me put on my less pessimistic hat or less antagonistic hat toward the UN and talk about a couple of the things that it does that I think the U.S. has an interest in seeing it do. One is that it is important to have a multilateral place for states to be able to negotiate. And whatever one says about the Security Council and the P5 and all that kind of stuff, the fact is that it causes very important discussions to be held at least partly in public. All right. Now, granted, they all go into a closed session, but they are held in a room that has got multiple countries involved rather than being simply bilateral negotiations, secret deals, all sorts of other stuff. There is a certain element that makes this more public and more transparent than it otherwise would. And that's probably on balance conducive to reducing conflict and reducing threats to peace. Second thing is there are functions that the UN performs that the US can't and the US wants to see done, of which the most important turns out to be a highly technical but also highly political one of UN peacekeeping operations. Heaven knows there are procurement scandals involving billions and billions and billions of dollars. There are, of course, all the sex scandals involved with, you know, everything that goes along with that. There are lots of problems, but I think it is also fair to say that UN peacekeeping operations have significantly improved outcomes in many places in the world. And the U.S. could not possibly do that itself. I mean, it has to wind up working through an institution that is at least on the surface able to claim universal validity out of that. So that, I think, is a hugely important function. And the U.S. could not do it alone. Mm-hmm.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems, too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and, of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So you replace, in your construction, both the sort of hyper-enthusiasm for engagement with the UN and UN institutions, and this kind of blithe idea that you can just get rid of it, with a series of kind of messy, what you call heuristics, which basically say, don't think of the UN as one institution. Think of it as a whole series of institutions, and make highly individualized judgments regarding how you're going to engage with the particular subunit of the UN that you're dealing with. So walk us through the heuristics that you propose, why certain institutions deserve different kinds of engagements.
Okay. The backdrop to the right way to engage with particular parts of the UN, the backdrop to that is that the US plays a double role in the world here. One is that it is, within the UN system, the most powerful actor, if it wants to be. And that's within the structure of the UN itself, simply on account of wealth and all the usual stuff. But the second role that the US plays is a parallel one, in which it is the kind of loose hegemon for the world, providing certain kinds of crucial public goods, particularly in the areas of collective security, but also in large areas related to the global economy. So the reserve currency of the dollar is not a UN function, and it has, you know, very little to do with the United Nations. But the security of the high seas is essentially a global public good that for the past 50 years has been, or more, has been largely conveyed by the United States Navy. And what that means is that there's a whole series of public goods and also actors in the form of countries that do not really depend on the UN for very important things that if they took the UN seriously, they might have to depend on for. So NATO countries do not look to the UN for collective security to defend them. They look to NATO, which is to say they look to the United States. Many other countries don't wind up looking to the UN for collective security, because even those countries, not NATO, not Japan, Australia, that sort of gold tier, you know, gold-plated tier of countries, they wind up still looking to the U.S. for things like the freedom of the seas and the openness of the sea lanes. That sort of public goods is part of what the U.S. provides. And that kind of loose hegemony means that everybody can pay lip service at the UN to the notion of collective security precisely because they don't really depend on it. And that frames the general question, I think, about heuristics, which says, how should the U.S. engage with the UN? And it causes one to ask the further question, should the U.S. be engaging with the UN or some part of the UN on the basis of being a powerful or most powerful player within the UN system? Or alternatively, is it engaging with the UN on the basis of being the alternative parallel loose hegemon who's providing these various kinds of global public goods? All right, that's a long-winded answer to that really just sort of sets the frame. Now, the UN itself divides its activities into a couple of different general areas, and traditionally they're thought of as being collective security and international peace, kind of all the security questions taken together. Second, then, there's a set of questions related to the internal running of the UN, the internal management of the UN, its own efficiency, and many specialized agencies that's kind of attached to it. The third would be the development, essentially the human development, economic development, international development kinds of questions that the UN attempts to address, at least in part. And then finally, what we could call a sort of the UN of values, right? Meaning human rights, democracy, values that the UN says that it represents in virtue of being the UN. And I think the question is how the U.S. should relate to each of those functions and the particular organs of the UN that address those particular issues.
So let's start with the security organs. You group those as entities that the United States should always engage with. Why?
Because the U.S. is in a position regarding security where it cares enormously, would be involved anyway, and the Security Council offers, on account of the veto, an opportunity for the United States to always be a player, but to always draw the line about where it doesn't want to be pulled. And so in that sense, these are questions that the U.S. will always care about very deeply. And the Security Council, and in particular being a P5 member of the Security Council, allows the United States to engage in the security questions in a way that it can operate both as the most powerful player on that council in terms of the projection of actual force and all of those metrics, but also as this parallel provider of security who has to be in a position of interrelating those two. And the Security Council is the place in which it can always do that.
So the Security Council we always engage with. Talk about the areas where this is where the category you call sometimes engage, and specifically, what are the circumstances? Briefly, but what are the circumstances in which we should and should not engage with with entities in that category, and what are those entities?
But many of the UN organs are organs in which the U.S. is quite happy to see the function performed, right? So it's really just a question of how effective it is. Is it institutionally corrupt? Are the people involved in it basically just sort of rent-seeking? Are they effective at what it is they do in activities that the United States would like to see performed?
So, like, what's an example of this?
It would be these subsidiary organs of the United Nations that deal with standard settings around, say, telecommunications, for example.
I see. So good functions, someone's got to do it, why not be the UN?
And the UN may well have developed a whole series of expertise in these areas, often which predate the UN. So when it comes to things like telecommunications, mail, things like that, these institutions actually date back before the UN are sort of absorbed in. Now, what's interesting is that you say sometimes, and here's the sometimes. The U.S. looks at, say, the Internet and thinks, there are certain functions here which we think would be really bad to hand over to the UN because they would immediately become politicized and in ways that would be bad for us, and we think bad for everybody else. And so we think that the right way to engage on this is to, up to a certain point, and then essentially tell them no. And in those kinds of areas, the U.S. has got an enormous amount of ability to wind up saying this and no further, and to engage in diplomacy to get others to come along with this process. There are others in which the politicization process, and it, you know, unsurprisingly, very often involves issues around Israel, or hot-button issues of this kind, in which the U.S. Really has to make a decision about when those entities decide to go places the U.S. is not prepared to go. UNESCO, for example, right? And it's an earlier sort of spasm of craziness back in the 80s that caused the Reagan administration to withdraw from that particular organ of the U.N. We eventually came back when the U.S. thought that it had been sufficiently cleaned up, but now over issues of Palestinian sovereignty and Israel and those sorts of things, the U.S. is back in the position of having to say, are we going to walk again? So the U.S. has to make decisions about both whether it believes that its resources, its time, its money, and its the legitimacy that it confers upon the organization are sufficiently justified by the effectiveness of the organization on the one hand. Other times it will be a question of, is the particular organ of the UN simply anti-American or sufficiently anti-U.S. interests that more effective is actually not a desirable thing?
So third category you write about, you call parallel engagement. And I think it's sort of particularly limited to the field of international development.
Yeah. Now, parallel development, it's striking that people who do collective security, international law scholars who do international organizations, this whole field of development is a really different area for a lot of folks in that case. But there is a pattern which is deeply embedded in the UN in the development area, which can be briefly said, give us money, right? Give us control over the money. If you don't actually give us the funds, then we will nonetheless tell you where we think the funds ought to be spent and how it ought to be spent and the rest. And the most recent version of this is the millennial development goals that were laid out back in 2000, or really in the couple of years before that, which was to be the most massive global anti-poverty thing that had ever been seen. And the U.S. balked at that, largely because it couldn't see that there was sufficient agreement around how to actually pursue international development that it made sense to pursue a single strategy for this. And hence, the U.S. said, we're going to set up our own sort of parallel thing. And I describe it as parallel because it's not disagreement with the goal in principle. It's rather to say, nobody really knows what works in this area. And so the best thing to do is to engage in parallel activities where people pursue the goal themselves and try to see what works, and maybe at some point they converge on something and maybe they don't. And that is what seems to me to be appropriate in the international development area at this point.
So finally, there's the areas where, you know, the UN really makes people mad, you know, particularly the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly. You put in a category called disengage and obstruct. And I think a lot of people will take a lot of emotional satisfaction from that chapter. I certainly did. Tell us about the activity. What characterizes the activity of the UN that we should actively seek to undermine, and what the processes you think we should use to undermine those activities look like?
Well, I guess I think, first of all, that practically anything related to the General Assembly. I describe it in the book as being the seat of waste and wickedness. Right? And that the problem with the General Assembly as a heuristic is simply to contain it. Now, I don't wind up recommending defunding it or withholding dues under all but very narrow circumstances because, frankly, the amount of money is not that much, and I think it's better to actually supply them with funding, which people can essentially squabble over, because I think that their squabbling is actually a better use of their time from the U.S. view, rent-seeking and that kind of activity that doesn't produce very much. Because if they got more efficient, they'd simply be more anti-American. And we don't actually want to see that. Now, then one moves into the chief values organs of the United Nations and ask, what on earth happened here?
So what other than the Human Rights Councils are these?
Well, there are a series of special rapporteurs that would, for example, report is too strong a word. They're independent special rapporteurs who are appointed by the Human Rights Council to report on particular things. Sometimes they do fantastically good work, almost always where it is around a particular country other than Israel, where they are reporting on the human rights conditions in that situation. Other times their work is, quote, thematic, where they're around particular issues, extrajudicial execution, torture, various things, and a lot of that depends really on how the special rapporteur defines its work, his or her work. They're independent, often academic experts, and the U.S. has done some very crazy things in attempting to accommodate itself to try and make it ingratiate itself to the world. So the U.S. has accepted the appointment of a special rapporteur around indigenous issues. The special rapporteur, who is a professor of law at the University of Arizona, Arizona State, one of the two, but in other words, from out there, is a Native American who was called upon the U.S. to return much of South Dakota to the Sioux, including the area covered by Mount Rushmore. Now, the U.S. signed on to the mandate that created this special rapporteur as though this were entirely a kind of positive, feel-good thing to do, in large part because it had not the faintest intention of paying any attention to what the special rapporteur said once the special rapporteur said it. And one of the very big arguments in this book is that these kind of apparently cost-free exercises in value symbolism are actually quite costly indeed, and that other parties do take real signals from the U.S.'s willingness to sign on to things but then not pay any attention to it afterwards, and that signing on to exercises in symbolism of human rights at the U.N., knowing in advance that they are unconstitutional from the U.S.'s perspective, that they cannot possibly be accepted within the U.S. constitutional or domestic legal order, is actually a really terrible thing for the cause of human rights, because it simply promotes hypocrisy across the entire system.
The book is Living with the U.N., American Responsibilities and International Order, by Ken Anderson, Lawfare's fearless book review editor. Ken, thanks for taking the time to chat.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare podcast, a project of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.